Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Goals on Film, Edge of the Crowd's dedicated sports movies podcast. I'm your host, Jason, and I've got Dan and Stewie with me this week. How have you both been?
Yep, I've been pretty good, thanks, mate. Great movie we've got to talk about this week. Dan, how are you going, mate? Pretty well.
Yeah, I'm going well. The footy's been good to me recently. Things are looking all right in the personal life. And I had two fantasy football drafts over the weekend, so it feels like football season. So now is the time for this movie, I reckon.
Yeah, well, let's talk about this particular football and not any other particular type of football because we are celebrating the return of college football and the NFL, which at the time of releasing this episode, it is the first day of the new season. And as such, we're taking a look at 2006 American football film, We Are Marshall. Now, to give you a bit of a rundown as to what this film is about, it is based on a true story. That is the story of where, after a loss to East Carolina University, a tragic plane crash in November of 1970, where virtually all of the Marshall University football team, the Thundering Herd, along with coaches, administrators, fans, and air crew, died as a result, and the film follows the aftermath of this particular plane crash. Thinking that it's a good idea to field a team still the following season, Nate Ruffin, who was one of the remaining players that stayed back and wasn't on the flight, he bands together the remaining members of the team who didn't make the trip, which ends up being three players only, while the president seeks out new coaches, setting on Jack Lengel. The team is mostly comprised of returning players, three varsity and 15 sophomores, as well as walk-on athletes from other sports programs at the university, as the team band together in the wake of the tragedy. Marshall loses its first game of the 1971 season to the Moreland State Eagles, 29-6. However, the team's first post-crash victory happens a week later at their home field, where they win 15-13 against Xavier University, with the Marshall University fans celebrating long after the final whistle and not wanting to leave. I don't know about you guys, but I feel like this is probably the saddest movie that we've done on Goals on Film yet. And that was at least my sort of like reaction to it. But Dan, Stewie, what was your reaction to this film? What did you think about it overall? What did you like about it? What didn't you like about it, if there was anything?
So just a bit of a peek behind the curtain here. We were talking off mic about just the tsunami of emotions this movie makes you feel in the first 30 minutes. I think it's a good movie. It's a good time. It's just your classic sports underdog movie, I guess. You know, all the players die, they have to get a new team together under a new coach, and you know, it's a tried and tested formula, and it works, and it works again in this movie.
Yeah, it really did kind of hit all those emotional things. And I think this was one of those first movies that I saw kind of as an early teenager, that you saw the sports movies really push the emotional side of the underdog trope. Because we often get that, you know, oh, they're down and, you know, they're no chance to win, they're up against the favorite. But you don't often see the grief and kind of anger and sadness that comes along with something like the events of this movie and the reality of this movie. And I think this was kind of a really interesting foray on that front for me, and definitely one that stuck in my mind.
Yeah, I think that there were so many moments that just brought tears to your eyes. And I think, like, you know, underlying all of that is like the fact that this actually did happen, this tragedy, and it was about real people with real emotions, and like, you know, the aftermath of what happened, and like, you know you could actually feel what was happening, you know, through the screen, through these characters, and just building that this program back up again, and like wanting to, you know, like go through that stage of like, you know, do we do this, to wanting to do it, to actually like, you know, going through with it as well. And like, so, you know, you just rode that all the way. And like, you know, the fact that it only sort of happened within the space of like, you know, 6 month sort of like time span as well, or 6 or 8 month time span from like, you know, the end of that season when the plane crash happened and to the start of the season, like, you know, it didn't really give you that much time to like sort of, you know, to see yourself like grieving, but like, you know, you still were feeling that like grief that, you know, all the characters were displaying as well.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think it's helped by the cast too. Like, not the entire cast are household names, but a lot of those main players are, really, really good actors. Ian McShane, Anthony Mackie, Matthew Fox. So I think they help, kind of convey those emotions onto the screen for sure.
And I find it really interesting because I'm not the biggest fan of Matthew McConaughey. I find him to be really polarizing either. But a lot of the time I find that I can't stand him in movies. And this was one of those performances that, yes, it was a lot. And there were times where it felt a little bit almost contrived, but it was still a really powerful performance by McConaughey. And he brought that kind of his unusual eccentric style to the role without taking away from kind of what you expected to feel out of the work, out of the movie.
I'm surprised you're not a fan of Matty Mac, Dan. I was saying just before you joined us that he's probably one of the most underrated actors of his generation. He hits a lot more than he misses, in my opinion.
I mean, this is a conversation that we can save for next time we relaunch the debate podcast, whether Matthew McConaughey is overrated or underrated.
I do agree. I think his acting style definitely lends itself to the role that he plays in this movie for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And we'll get into that either on the debate pod or maybe in our segment where we talk about the actors. But we will move on and we will look at the references to history throughout this movie. And we've already established that it is based on a true story. And so, like, we'll just give a bit of a background, I guess, in terms of how true it is, and what parts of it were true and what parts of it might have been falsified or, changed up for the movie. And we'll just start on the plane itself and the crash itself. And so Southern Airways Flight 932 was a chartered flight from Kingston in North Carolina to the Huntington Tri-State in West Virginia. The plane was carrying 37 team members, 8 members of the coaching staff, 25 boosters, 4 flight crew, and 1 charter company employee. And as we established on November 14, 1970, at 7:35 p.m., the plane crashed into a hill just short of Tri-State Airport, killing all 75 on board. Because it was the team's only chartered flight of the season, many prominent citizens were on board, including a city councilman, a state legislator, and 4 of the city's 6 physicians. I think we got that in the movie as well. Someone said, it wasn't just players and coaches on board. It was, a lawyer. It was a council person as well.
Have you mentioned this to any of the other board members?
A few. Most of them would prefer not to think about it.
I can understand that sentiment.
Doesn't make sense to rush right back into it, Our coaching staff, gone. Our athletic department, gone. So many of our boosters, gone. We have to start all over again from scratch. My God, we don't have the resources or the manpower right now.
I know all the reasons to suspend the program, Paul. I'm just surprised to hear it coming from you.
This town just didn't lose a football team, Doc. We lost doctors, lawyers, city councilmen. We lost father, son, husband. How many kids lost a parent? How many kids lost both parents?
28.
Wouldn't be a game anymore, Don. Be a weekly reminder of what we've lost. And I just don't see how that would do anyone in this town any good.
And so it's good to know that, they sort of honored those people in terms of explaining that these were real people with real sort of roles in this sort of small community.
I've got a question for you, Jace. Maybe you can answer it. Maybe you can't. Maybe you can, Dan. I'm not too sure. But what are 25 boosters?
So in American sports, boosters are often parents, alumni, friends of the school that have kept some involvement and in the days of amateur sports, supported programs and occasionally athletes to ensure that the programs have enough money to run with all the right infrastructure.
Gotcha.
So they're kind of friends of the university, friends of the team sort of thing.
Right. Understood.
I think it's interesting to note as well that this was not the only plane crash of note within a particular sort of time frame to this particular Marshall University one. And I think that they sort of alluded to it in the film as well, like on one of the first sort of news or radio broadcasts, they were like, there's been another plane crash. And so 6 weeks before the Marshall plane crash, one of two chartered planes carrying the Wichita State University football team en route to a game in Logan, Utah, crashed into the side of a mountain in Colorado. The plane carried upperclassmen, the head coach, other team staff, university officials, and several boosters, and 39 people died, about half of them players. 9 survived, including the co-pilot. So I guess it's really interesting to note that, like, you know, these two events happen so similarly to each other, so close in time to each other, and, you know, both, you know, university football teams.
Yeah, I mean, you almost have to wonder, was it worth getting on a plane at any point during that season if you were a football fan or football booster or anything like that? It's pretty terrifying. And I mean, it does show how far we have come as a world, really, that air travel now, you know, is not thought about with any sort of serious risk. And we had two college teams in the space of 6 weeks who were devastated. And the crash for the Wichita State team would have had a very similar impact to the Marshall team, with the head coach and upperclassmen. Those are the players you've built your program around who carry it on to the next generation. So it would have had a really tough effect on them as well.
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting that you say that, you know, there'd be a bit of nervousness about going onto a plane. After the film was released, Marshall University returned to East Carolina University, and all the players were given the option of traveling by plane or bus. Marshall lost the game 33-20 and returned to Pitt Greenville Airport. The plane was delayed due to mechanical problems, with several players opting then to take the bus instead of traveling on the plane. So I think that, yeah, like the effect was still very much there.
I mean, if you want to talk about suspicion, a superstition in sport, that'd be off the charts on every sort of metric of how you measure superstition and the likelihood of someone opting out of something because of it.
Absolutely. If I was a part of that team and I rocked up to that airport, and they said, oh, your plane is delayed a little bit due to mechanical issues, you wouldn't be able to pay me enough to get on that plane. I would be freaking out.
Well, and they're all amateur players as well, so they're not getting paid at all.
Yeah, exactly.
Throughout the film, it sort of like referenced Jack Lengel's sort of approach to coaching and approach to recruiting players. The real life Jack Lengel, he said that it started out rocky, just as it did in the film, where many of the larger schools poached recruits from, you know, this particular, like from Marshall University, following the crash. Yeah, so I think, and like, I think it was very much true as well that, you know, they had all these walk-ons from different of the university's sports programs as well. And so, like, you know, they actually did draft a basketball player, they did draft a soccer player, just because they exhibited the skills that you needed as a football player.
And to Dan's point earlier, like, imagine being a parent and the school approaches you, you know, to get your kid to play football there. Even though it was just like a horrible tragedy, just an accident, it would definitely give you pause. You'd be like, oh, I don't know if I want my kid taking that chance, you know?
I mean, we still see in modern day, from time to time, players drafted across from other sports to fill in. In 2020, Sarah Fuller became the first woman to play NCAA college football. She was a kicker. She played on the women's soccer team, and they'd had a COVID outbreak through the team and didn't have anyone who could kick for the weekend. So she became the kicker for the weekend.
Wow.
It's obviously different circumstances and everything different to this movie, where you've got one player who fills in one weekend during a pandemic. But certainly that idea of taking from other sports or borrowing players from other sports programs because, you know, you need someone or you like their skills, that absolutely still happens to this day.
Similarly, it mentions NCAA and how in 1971 and prior to that year, they didn't allow freshmen to compete in varsity football. And obviously Marshall University got that permission from the NCAA as well, and therefore earned the nickname the Young Thundering Herd for playing mostly freshmen.
Excuse me, I'm sorry to bother you like this, but my name is Don Dedman. I'm president of Marshall University. May I speak with you for a moment, please?
What are you doing in Kansas City, Don?
My town and my school, we're hurting. We want to play football, and we cannot do it without your help. Please.
Guess who's going to change our diaper?
Freshman at Marshall University. Is it right there? Is it signed? My president right there. There he is. Damn. Doc, we're going to get us a football team.
You know, that, you know, did, was allowed to happen. And so, like, you know, Marshall University did actually approach the NCAA and get that sort of special assistance, which obviously I think, like, you know, I would have granted that as well. Like, you know, if you're doing all this to field a team in the wake of this tragedy, like, you don't have enough sort of like first choice senior players. You know, I don't blame the NCAA for changing their rules up a bit just for this purpose at all. Like, I think it was really nice of them to do. And obviously they did.
I blame the NCAA for having that rule. The NCAA is a long broken institution.
I was surprised at the resistance to letting him play. Like, a tragedy like that happens. Surely, the bottom line is the bottom line for the NCAA. They want games played, right? So wouldn't they want a team fielded so they could fulfill contracts or whatever, like broadcast contracts?
We're getting into a very murky zone, but the NCAA have long been an organization resistant to any sort of change or anything that loosens their grip on college sports, because, I mean, it's a national organization that makes billions of dollars from players who don't make anything at all. And so to keep that grip is really important, because once players start making money, you get agency and who knows what happens after that.
Mm. So they're still pretty rigid on this no freshman rule now, or is that something might have been changed?
They abolished it not long afterwards because it became clear that actually freshmen could play at that, because the rule was there in the place under the guise that it protected 18-year-olds from getting, you know, destroyed by grown older men. And you started to see that actually, in fact, that there were some 18-year-olds who could compete in a blanket ban on all freshmen was unreasonable and didn't really carry that same safety backing. And so that was peeled away. And over the years, we started to see more of the NCAA rules peeled away, but it's still an organization that has its clutches on certain parts of college sports.
Particularly the purse strings.
Very much so.
We'll go into a bit of that now as well, Dan. And so, like, you know, as much as, you know, this story aims to tell things historically, accurately, being factually correct, there are some inaccuracies, and I've labeled these into two parts as well. So I've labeled one section being like, you could probably alter it, and one section titled that, you know, you can't help by the time that it was filmed. And so I think, like, you know, leading on from your example and your point just before as well, there was a scene during the training camp where Lingle tells one player to head slap the shit out of him if the opposing player goes for his knees.
Now, Creel, man outweighs you by 75 pounds, okay? When you're hitting him up high, he's going to beat you and you're going to be on your ass every single time, all right? So you got to come in here, a big man like that. You got to get him low. You got to get him in the legs, okay? That's how you're going to keep him from coming through the line. Stay low on him.
Well, what should I do if he goes low on me, coach?
That's a good question. George says, what is he going to do if he goes low? Five one comes low on me, huh? Oh, head slap and he's around him. Like that. See that? Head slap the shit out of him.
And so this was done in, you know, this movie was set obviously in 1970, 1971. The NCAA and NFL banned the head slap in the mid-1970s because of the head injuries that it caused.
What head injuries in this sport?
Gonna say,
and to comment,
it's been slow progress from there. I mean, yeah.
So I guess like just continuing these again, like, you know, you could probably alter it. And like, you know, you don't really know why it might have been changed or, you know, presented this way in the film. No players from the 1971 team have been elected to the Marshall Athletic Hall of Fame, just assistant coach Mickey Jackson. And similarly, the closing narration states that Jack Lengel is now in the College Football Hall of Fame. He was actually never inducted into the Hall of Fame, though he did receive an award.
I thought it was strange that his record was 9-33 and then he was in the Hall of Fame. That didn't make sense to me. So honestly, that's not a surprise.
Yeah, I mean, it would have made sense if you finished 9-33 and having kind of kept the program alive the way he did if he was a sentimental inductee, but I'm not shocked that he wasn't in the end. As for like no one being inducted from the 1971 class into the Hall of Fame, I'm not that surprised. They weren't a superstar team. And as much as certainly the movie portrays the, you know, Ian McShane and Anthony Mackie's as having these really big roles and driving the team, the reality is that the team was not good through no fault of their own. But no matter how good you are, if you play on a team that goes, you know, 9-33 over 4 years, you're not getting picked into many Hall of Fames.
They didn't have a winning record. Like, this is from the narration at the end of the film, but they didn't have a winning record to the mid-90s. Is that right?
Yeah, part of that doesn't surprise me. I mean, there are teams in the SEC these days that haven't had winning records in 25 years because Alabama's so good. So I don't read to it. It's not, and that's the thing about college sports, is that it doesn't have the same parity that the pro sports have. The rich get richer and the poor stay poor. So if you're not a good team, it's really hard to turn that around. And I think it probably took them 10, 12 years to rebuild the program. But I don't think the whole 25 years to get a winning record was all because of this. I think some of it was just the nature of college football.
Right.
Because a program will turn over in its entirety in college football within 4 years because players can only play 4 years. So
yeah.
Even if you lose a whole generation and, you know, it takes you 3 years to get your recruiting back, in theory, that's 7 years. And, you know, from sort of 2 years after that, you should have a rebuilt program.
When Don Dedman calls potential coaches, the area codes include 910, 573, 336, 850, and 478. These were all established in the early 90s up until 2000. And so at the time that this movie was set, these area codes didn't exist. And so I don't know how he was able to call these particular coaches.
Where are these area codes? Because I wonder if that's a like hallmark to, you know, the people who they thought would have been in the frame at the time.
Ooh, maybe.
That's a good point there, Dan.
Couldn't tell you,
you
that.
You know, those area codes might now be places where you'd be like, oh, yeah, that person was coaching there at the time. This should be them, even if, you know, the area code might be wrong. But you forgive something like that, don't we?
I mean, I didn't notice it when I was watching the movie. And so, you know, eagle-eyed people, you know, on the interwebs do. So we thank them.
How could you? Aren't you an expert in the history of US telephone area codes, Jason? I mean, that's what you're here for, isn't it?
No, I'm an expert in football helmets, though, and so we'll move on to the next point.
Oh, here we go.
Beautiful segue. Love it.
In the locker room soon after the crash, during the discussion about continuing the football program, a new 1971 football helmet is hanging on the wall.
Oh, that's it?
Yeah, that's
it. Oh. They missed it. They missed it by 6 months, or they got it by 6 months.
I guess missed it.
I mean, come on. Surely we're gonna pay that as like okay. I mean, helmet technology hasn't advanced a whole lot for the 20 years after that anyway. Who cares if you missed it by 6 months?
All right, Dan. What about this then? The logo on West Virginia University's football helmets at the time in 1971 was a small W with a large looping V and small U, not the basic black WVU as it was shown in the film. So what do you say about that?
That's unforgivable.
The modern logo is better than both. That's what I said to that. whoever got paid to upgrade the West Virginia logo was worth the money in the years following either of these things.
I guess like the last one, just on this one, is that in spring 1971, Jack Lengel and Red Dawson approach West Virginia University football coach Bobby Bowden for his use of the Veer formation. Dawson says that the two schools are rivals, and Bowden agrees to help, saying that we don't play you all this year.
I really don't think this is your best idea.
Hmm. Red! Good to see you again.
Coach.
How are you? And this must be...
Coach Jack Lengel.
Jack, Bobby Bowden.
Bobby Bowden.
Pleasure to meet you.
It's a pleasure to meet you. Bobby, thank you for taking the time with us today.
My pleasure, not a problem.
All right. Yes, sir.
So, I can't wait to hear. What can I do for you boys?
Well, the thing is, Coach, we're thinking about adopting the Veer this year. And I understand that to be your bread and butter, as it were. So we're just hoping that we could come down here and maybe you could give us a few pointers.
Pointers?
Tips. Advice. Anything that you'd be willing to show us. Well, we'd really appreciate it. You seem to be the man who runs it so well.
He's good.
You're the best at the Veer.
That's what they say. Playbooks, research, game film. Need anything copied or dubbed, just see Kitty down the hall.
Coach, you serious?
Sure. We don't play y'all this year, so what the heck, have at it. Just make sure you put everything back where you found it when you threw.
Deal.
West Virginia University and Marshall are basketball rivals, and they hadn't played each other in football since 1923 and didn't again until 1997.
That's a big miss. But if you want a little bit of a cross plug, the Veer, the formation that they use at Marshall, is the same formation that they use in Remember the Titans. The system that he brings in to run is the Veer. It's the same because it was, you know, historically that was the system a lot of teams used at the time. It was a simplified system that worked if you didn't have the talent to play O-line, which in the case of both Remember the Titans and We Are Marshall, they didn't have. But I thought that's a nice little interesting cross between the two.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously, if you haven't listened to that episode of Goals on Film, our very first episode that we did, do go back and listen after you've done listening with this one. All right. So I prefaced this earlier as some inaccuracies that you can't help the time that it was filmed. And so in the 1970s, Marshall played their home football games at Fairfield Stadium, which was demolished in early 2004. And so Herndon Stadium in Atlanta was used as a stand-in for Fairfield Stadium in this particular movie.
Just missed it.
I mean, it felt like they did a pretty good job of shaping it up. And they definitely didn't do as much damage to it as... have you seen The Dark Knight Rises and what they did to Heinz Field in that movie? Feels like they did a better job with this one here.
However, you can see the new stadium, the newly built stadium, in one of the particular shots. And so it's when Nate and another varsity player are talking on the rooftop of the campus building. You can see the new library and the new football stadium, both that were built in the 1990s, visible in the background. Apparently, the stadium only appears once and is edited out in the subsequent shots.
That scene, right? With Nate and the guy who can't go back to play football.
Hey, look. You know, when they first roomed us together freshman year, I wasn't too sure about you. You know? But we stuck it out, and now you're my best friend. I mean, remember freshman two-a-days? I'm puking my guts out, and I want to quit football, and you won't let me? Now, you never gave up on us out there on the field, and I'm not going to give up on you now. Oh, man. It's our team. Now, they left this to us. Now it's up to us. It's on our shoulders, man. I need you with me, Tom.
I should have been with them, Nate. I should have been with them.
Look, Tom, I understand.
No, you don't. No, you don't, Nate. You don't.
What you talking about?
I overslept. That's why I wasn't on the plane, Nate. I overslept. I wasn't hurt or sick. And I should have been there. I should have been with them. I'm sorry. I just can't play football right now. Okay? It's not in me. I can't do it. You understand that, right? Look at me. I'm sorry.
Okay. I bigged up the cast before. It's a fantastic cast. That guy is a terrible actor. He was just trying his hardest to hang with Anthony Mackie, and he just, oh, he was woeful. Absolutely woeful. Was not a fan. And looks like you got thoughts on that, mate.
I mean, I found that conversation really touching. Anthony Mackie did carry that scene. So I'm not going to argue with that, but that scene really did kind of hit. And that was one of the scenes that I found pretty relatable, because I was like, you know, if it was me, I don't know if I'd be able to go back.
Yeah. The sentiment, totally. The scripting, beautiful. The acting, you know, was 50% lacking there. I just thought he was really, he was giving it everything and probably could have done with dialing it down a notch or two. Like, there's other ways to, well, you know, it's all subjective, but to me, there's other ways to convey that same emotion, I think.
When the tall player is recruited off the basketball court, the basketball hoop is portable with a breakaway rim. Marshall's basketball gym has the same rims. However, breakaway rims were invented after 1981.
What were these guys doing? Were they even trying?
Similarly,
that feels like something you can't fix. Like, if you're going to go and film in the Marshall gym, which is what they should have done and what they did.
Yeah.
If they've got different rims that, you know, weren't invented at the time, not going to uninstall the rims for the sake of two scenes in the movie. Like, I reckon that's fine.
Well, similarly, the basketball court in the gym has a three-point line, which the NCAA adopted in 1983 and the National Federation of High School Rules adopted in 1984.
See, that feels like something they could have peeled off and put back up.
I guess the other ones, just to finish quickly, just involve like a couple of cars that didn't exist at the time. So apparently minivans didn't exist in 1971. And similarly as well, when they first learn of the plane crash and Nate and his teammate ride to the site, they're riding in a 1972 GMC truck.
Given that it's a 2006 movie, they've done pretty well to get that close to the year, I reckon.
They tried real hard, particularly with that truck, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, that truck did not look like it had been kept in pristine condition for someone to reenact a 1970 movie. Like, they did some restoration work on that truck.
And yeah, just finishing this one. When Lengel runs out of the house chasing his son and sees Marshall fans walking to the first home game against Xavier, pink and white blooms are visible on the dogwood trees in the background. This game was played in September 1971 when the dogwoods would not have been in bloom.
Yeah, it's always the thing about football is that you want to convey the like start of the new season, something new, but football is played in autumn, not spring.
Mm-hmm.
You dove deep. For this, Jace, that's a good one. I enjoyed that. About the flowers, that's good. That's something that completely went straight over my head. I did not pick up on that one.
Well, I've got some extra fun facts for you, Stewie.
Can't wait. Lay them on me.
The blazer that Matthew McConaughey wears during his speech at the cemetery is the color of his own alma mater, the University of Texas in Austin.
Wow. Hook 'em horns. Hook 'em horns. Texas are the Longhorns. And yeah, he's notorious for being a UT alum. I am a little bit surprised they let him wear it in the scene, to be honest.
Yeah.
Like, it's a pretty recognizable color.
At least I wonder if the logo or the name.
I wonder if it was one of those things, you know, Jack Nicholson in The Departed wouldn't wear a Boston hat, like a Red Sox hat. He just flatly refused. So I wonder if it was a little bit of that where he's like, well, let me just wear this. I'm not going to wear anything else.
All of the characters, including Coach Lingle, constantly pronounce Worcester College's name incorrectly, as if it rhymes with rooster, so like Rooster College, whereas the correct Worcester. Pronunciation is Worcester, like, you know, the Massachusetts city.
Or like Worcester. The source.
That's what I was going to say.
I feel like that's bad, but that someone's job has to be like, no, 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 this is how you pronounce it to all of them. Like, it's unforgivable when it's everyone. It's like someone has forgotten the memo. It's like when one person mispronounces it, you're like, they just, you know, there's a speech thing or whatever they could do. But when everyone gets it wrong, like, you made a decision not to get it right.
Someone dropped the ball there for sure.
A couple of just like, you know, corrections, I guess, continuity. After recruiting the new players, the coaches talk about having a quarterback named John Caddy. When they go to the field to practice, Lingle asks about his options for quarterback and no one mentions John Caddy. So obviously didn't get him in the end, you know?
That's fair.
At halftime of the Xavier versus Marshall game, the radio announcer refers to the Xavier Pirates. They're actually the Xavier Musketeers. And I perhaps think the biggest one, continuity-wise, or it's a bit geographical, apparently, at the beginning, when people are driving to the plane crash site, the cars are driving away from Cerrito, where the plane actually crashed. So some...
How on earth they would know that is, like, how someone would be able to pick, like, they're driving away.
That's incredible to me that someone picked up on that.
Someone has spent too much time playing GeoGuessr when they watched that movie.
Well, there have been some traditions to stem from this particular moment in time of the plane crash at Marshall University as well. And we got it at the start and we got it at the end as well. And that is the annual fountain ceremony. And so the Student Government Association holds a memorial service each year on the anniversary of the plane crash. And basically, as is tradition, the water in the fountain is stopped during the service and remains silent until the springtime. And so it was created by sculptor Harry Bertoia, and it was his hope that the fountain would commemorate the living rather than death on the waters of life rising, receding, surging, so as to express upward growth, immortality, and eternity.
Well, that's just nice. Yeah.
There is a bronze plaque that bears this simple, eloquent inscription. They shall live on in the hearts of their families and friends forever, and this memorial records their loss to the university and to the community. So I think, yeah, it's nice that they honoured that. And I think that, yeah, that sort of end scene was pretty much one of these ceremonies, really. You know, you had so many people in attendance. And so, like, I could only guess that that was a, you know, if not, you know, a real ceremony, you know, that they sort of captured what actually happens on this particular day, on this particular anniversary.
It was good. Yeah. I don't know if we're going to get into this later, but I'm a sucker for it, particularly in sports movies, when they splice in real footage. So I thought it was cool with the new stuff. And then the closing credits where I had the highlights from the team and stuff. I thought that was really cool. It was really well done.
Yeah, I always love when they do that. You're right, the splicing of real footage in and kind of linking it back so you can remember that it's not only based on a true story, but these people were real too.
Yeah, absolutely. Great point, Dan.
Yeah, I think I really enjoyed, like, yeah, those news broadcasts at the start. And then in the final credits, there was actually footage of the 1970 season featuring players who did perish in the crash. And so, like, obviously, and, like, you know, similarly as well, like, you know, you had your real life counterparts versus who they you know, the movie character as well. And so like that sort of like side by side comparison. And yeah, like I think that that really like, you know, sort of like hit hard that, you know, this was based on real life, that they were able to use like this archive footage, that they had this archive footage and were able to show, you know, just sort of like, you know, the team itself and who these people were based on. We'll now move into how true to the sport this particular movie is. And there's a couple of things that I have before, Dan, I might throw to you for anything that you have. Again, these are like a bit of like inaccuracies. I think I'm famous for them, for telling you guys what these are. But the goalposts on the field are 18 feet, 6 inches across. In the 1970s, the goalposts were 23 feet, 4 inches across, and they were narrowed in 1991.
How do you know this? How do you know this? Is this from research, or are you at your TV screen with the tiniest tape measure and adjusting for scale?
Yeah, that.
Well, I'm curious as to whoever's decided that that's just like, what scale did you use to determine that? Or like...
I think it goes back to what you were saying before, Dan, you know, with the geography thing. Just people with too much time on their hands watching this movie too many times.
And people who can't enjoy the movie. Because, like, I feel like if you're enjoying the movie and engrossed in the movie, you're not being like, oh, those posts too wide.
Ruined it. It's ruined the whole thing. Can't watch it. The posts are too wide.
The only other one that I have here is that during the first half of the Xavier game, a defender recovers a fumble and returns it for a long gain. Until 1990, a defensive player could not advance a recovered fumble.
I didn't know that rule, because that, to me, is someone who's come to football in the last, you know, 2.5 decades. That's a legal play. Yeah. The fact that it wasn't at the time never occurred to me.
Well, there you go.
And I did mention it earlier. I think that they use the veer, and that is obviously really kind of linked to the time. And on the whole, I think that they got the football pretty much right in most of it. You know, there's the game looks like it's really happening. It looks like, you know, the timing's right and the field is right, and it doesn't look like they jump around too much. The skills are fine. They look realistic enough that, you know, you're not sure whether it's actors or people playing football. It doesn't feel like it's actors who are trying to look like they're playing football. You know, in some movies, they get the acting really wrong in the live sporting sequences, but they really got it right, I think, in this movie.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, like, you know, it's just like the whole college thing as well, in terms of, you know, having a team come together, you know, sort of like who plays. And, you know, everything that I've sort of seen, like, you know, you obviously have, you know, the, you know, just the play itself happening out on the field and like who calls what, and you know, just seeing like the tactics that go into it. Like, you know, you were mentioning just before, Dan, the veer formation. You know, I don't know about any of the other plays that were called that, you know, would potentially happen or like be drawn up in a real game, or like if any of the ones that were mentioned were real plays as well. But like, yeah, I think that everything like sort of like the movie encapsulated about the sport itself and like how it was played and how it was sort of like conveyed on the screen, like, is everything that I sort of like know in terms of like watching football, just in terms of like, you know, the pace of it and like, you know, the movements and you know, yeah, just who calls what and what happens.
Yeah, exactly. I think they did a good job on this one. But I think that was always going to be a key focus, because they had to get it right. You can't have a movie about a football team that loses and wins and not do the live sequence as well. Like, it's not like it's a sideshow to it. It was the key part of the movie in many ways.
Yeah. Before we move on to looking at the cast list, Dan, you have some information about a lawsuit that Warner Bros. Basically received after doing this film. Do you want to tell us more?
Yeah. So in 2000, there was a documentary about the whole incident. It's called Marshall University, Ashes to Glory. And they sued Warner Brothers for copyright infringement and also apparently fraud and breach of contract. over this movie. And the director of that documentary was a Marshall alumnus, so probably not a great person to be on the wrong side of, but they did win the lawsuit in summary judgment, which means that the judge says, here's, you know, the summary of the case, it's all done. You're out or you're in. So Warner Brothers won it pretty comfortably. So I'm going to assume that there wasn't any real copyright infringement, fraud, or breach of contract in that case.
All right, we will move on and look at the cast list now. And we've touched on a few of them, but I will just run you through the main cast list. And so we had Matthew McConaughey as Jack Lengel. We had Matthew Fox as Red Dawson. Anthony Mackie as Nate Ruffin. Ariane Escapeta as Reggie Oliver. David Strathairn as Donald Deadman. Ian McShane as Paul Griffin. And Kate Mara as Annie Cantrell. You know, as I said, like you've already alluded to a couple of their performances, but is there anyone else that you might want to single out or maybe just like extend upon what you've already said about a particular actor and their performance?
Listen, I'm a big fan of Kate Mara. Anything she is in, I'm a very big fan of. So I was delighted to see her at the very start of the movie. She doesn't have a great role, but... you know, great as in big. She doesn't have a big role, like a huge role. You wouldn't say she's one of the leading cast, but she's fantastic, and she's always fantastic. Everything that she's in, I won't hear a bad word said about her.
You won't hear a bad word about Kate Mara from me. But for me, this is one of Anthony Mackie's coming out moments. This is really him on the big stage in a big leading role, taking on kind of a pretty sophisticated persona and role. I mean, it's a complex character that he's playing and he does it really well. You really kind of get a sense of that. So big thumbs up from me on that one. And this is one of Matthew McConaughey's good movies. I'm not always a McConaughey fan, and I know Stewie's going to ask for me to be banned from Goals on Film as a result of that comment tonight, but this is a strong performance by McConaughey, I think.
Yeah, I'm a bit big Matthew McConaughey fan. I'll forgive you for that horrible take, Dan. he is fantastic. I will agree with you. He is fantastic in this movie. And was this on mic or off mic? We said this. I can't remember. But his style of acting really lends itself to this role. He's really good. Yeah. Ian McShane is fantastic in this too. You know, I think he just got the headline kind of, you know, Ian McShane. Because he's Ian McShane, I don't think he's like he plays a major character, but he doesn't have a lot of screen time. I didn't think a lot of his screen time is just sitting in the diner eating food or standing in the what was that like a still works or something?
He does still do a really good job of capturing the kind of emotional side. Yeah, he's not in the the script, but he does play a kind of really big anchor role in this film of kind of centering it back on the important parts of it, the emotions.
I'd agree with that. Matthew Fox was pretty good in this movie too, I thought. I don't know what he's doing these days, but he's not doing movies or TV or anything, but Matthew Fox, bit of a throwback to the early noughties.
Yeah, definitely. I think that you know, you obviously know the story, and I'm sure that all these actors either would have known the story or like really like learnt the story prior to filming. And I think that, yeah, all of them were able to really convey like, you know, the, you know, wave of emotions that, you know, you would expect people to be feeling as a result of what happened. And so like you got that, you know, at every turn, you know, you really got how everyone was feeling in the aftermath of this and like, you know, as the sort of football season builds up and continues to sort of progress throughout the first couple of games of that 1971 season. And like, I think that, yeah, I think everyone was able to really get into like their particular character and really like, you know, give off a performance that really sort of said like, you know, these people are grieving because of this and like, you know, the backstories onto why. And, you know, you really got that, like, you know, throughout their sort of like expressions or like, you know, just their use of the voice. You know, you got like the sort of like people who were really like, you know, bumbly in terms of like, you know, just going over their words, you know, just because of like all the sadness. You got the people who were like really angry as well, like, you know, that like, you know, anger hidden behind the sadness as well. And, you know, like I look at like a scene of, you know, I'll give Kate Mara a bit of a rev up here, Stewie, you know, her scene of, you know, wanting to give the ring back to Paul, you know, played by Ian McShane.
I think you should have his back.
Chris gave it to you.
Yeah, I did. But you gave it to your wife first. And then you passed it down to him, so I'm passing it back up to you. It should stay in your family.
What family? Honey? You keep it. Wear it. And every morning you put it on, you think of him.
I think, like, you know, you could see her like hands like trembling, and like it's just like those little things like that. I think that, yeah, as I said, like, you know, each actor was able to do really well.
Yeah, you can't fault a lot of the performances in this movie, except for the one that I referenced earlier. That one guy, probably not so great, but the rest of them were fantastic. You make a great point. That scene with Kate Mara, when she's going to give the ring back, that's fantastic. It's all good.
So, yeah, I guess as well, in my research, the character of Paul Griffin and Annie Cantrell, so Ian McShane's and Kate Mara's characters, respectively, they actually weren't based on real people. And so they essentially had to get into, you know, a character that was sort of like, you know, not involved in the actual events. And so Ian McShane was able to do this by drawing on his memories. And again, like it comes back to fatal plane crashes, but he was able to draw on his memories of the fatal plane crash of the Manchester United soccer team, having known some of the players. And so like that sort of like real world, you know, experience of like, yeah, just experiencing something like that, he was able to give that sort of performance in a movie that sort of like deals with the same sort of topic.
That's fascinating. I didn't know that. That's really good. It just speaks to how good of an actor Ian McShane is, I suppose.
Mm. The real life Red Dawson, he actually had a cameo in this movie. It was a non-speaking cameo, and it was the role of the head coach of Morehead State University, their football team. And obviously, in just more of my fun facts, the crowds in the large stadium scenes consist of hundreds of local extras, but wait, thousands of blow-up dummies and thousands of CG extras.
Wow, that's crazy. I've got to give you props here, Jace. You are just bringing it in this episode with all the little tidbits and bits of trivia that you've researched here. So it's, I feel like that needs to be acknowledged.
Thanks.
No, that's been great.
And so we'll move on now as well, and we will ask the question to both of you whether all these characters, for whoever they were, whatever they did, was there anyone that you found yourself relating to in any way, whether it was the character as a whole or some part of the character, or maybe it was just a line that the character said in the movie? Was there anyone like that for you guys?
I don't know how much relatable, but definitely the ones that I kind of had the most connection with were the guys on the football team who'd been there the season before, Anthony Mackie and the couple of others that were there, and the emotional turmoil they went through. Putting myself in their shoes, I was like, I have no idea which side of this one I would have come down on, whether I would have been, I want to play or I don't. I think that kind of, I really appreciate the fact that they did, it wasn't all one way or the other, and they did kind of go through those emotions as a group. That was something I really connected with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. That's a fantastic answer, Dan. I the Matthew Fox character, you know, just choosing to coach and then it maybe not being the right decision because he took off at the end of the year, like he said he would, I'll give you 1 year and never returned to football before. Like, I don't know. I feel like I would be wanting to give it a crack, but you don't know until you do it whether it's the right decision, you know? So I've been obviously not in that exact same situation, but that's definitely relatable to me, I think, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that sort of thing was the case with a lot of the characters. Like, you could say that about, Red Dawson. You could say that about Donald Deadman as well. Like, when Jack was like, you know, you need to go to the NCAA and get this overturned. Like, you can't just write letters or phone them. And, like, you know, his, like, Donald's, like, reluctance to do that until he does go out and, like, stand in the rain and demand it. And so, like, yeah, I think, like, my answer is similar to yours then, Stewie. Like, you know, just like those characters who have that sort of, like, reluctance to do anything at the start, just, like, because of, like, the, you know, the trauma, whether it is, like, the trauma or whether it is just, like, you know, going back into the fold or getting, like, the permission to continue something that like this after such a event. I think, like, yeah, it just shows, like, the character of some people that they will go back to something that, oh, like, you know, actually go towards, you know, helping, you know, a football club or football team and just, like, you know, for the benefit of, you know, the university. Like, they'll actually, like, go out and do these things for the benefit of the university. And so, like, yeah, as I said, I think, like, I'm the same with you, Stewie, in terms of that answer. I think that, yeah, there's certainly been, like, reluctance, but, you know, you have to do stuff for the benefit of others as well.
What a horrible situation for these, you know, like, obviously the staff and the teachers and the president and stuff. Like, it's tough for, you know, fully grown adults who have lived life and got a bit of life experience that they can draw upon, but particularly for the students who are still, you know, they're still growing up. They're not fully developed adults mentally, I suppose. Just thinking about that just then when you were giving your answer, like, what a horrible situation to find yourself in at 20 years old. I know personally I wouldn't have been capable of you know, fully grasping, you know, the situation and all the potential outcomes and the pros and cons when I was 20 years old. So yeah, you got to feel for the guys that were left behind, right?
Yeah,
absolutely.
All right, as we come to the end of this episode, we do ask a prompt, and this week it is, if you could have an American football film get made, what would it be and why? Dan, we'll go to you first.
See, I'm always torn because I feel like there's a lot of good stories about quarterbacks, but also there are so many movies about quarterbacks, and I'm a little bit over it. So I think actually a really fun one, this is a little bit different, be the Watt brothers. So JJ and TJ and Derek have all been elite NFL players for a long while now. JJ and TJ in particular, and a movie about them, I think it'd be kind of interesting. You know, three brothers growing up and all making it to the NFL and not necessarily in the positions that everyone kind of typically associates. You've got two defensive ends and a fullback, which is a position that's really going extinct. The other one would be a bit of a rags to riches on someone like Malcolm Butler. Butler was the one who had that miracle intercept for the Patriots against the Seahawks about a decade ago to win the Super Bowl as an undrafted rookie, which really means he was the last player kept on the roster. And for that guy to be the guy who wins you the Super Bowl at the end of the year is a pretty amazing story. So I reckon that'd be a fun one to get made as well.
Stewie, what do you have for us?
Well, Dan just stole both of mine, so I'm just going to have to think about it on the fly. Nah, I think a movie about a team that's struggling, you know, just trading picks to try and get the number one pick on draft day would be really good. Maybe Kevin Costner could play the lead role. Wait a minute. No. The XFL. Vince McMahon, WWE Supremo,
yes,
decided to start a football league. It was a bit of a dumpster fire, but, you know, it encapsulated the late 90s, early 2000s vibe, a bit like, I don't know if you guys have seen any Woodstock 99 docos that have popped up on the streaming services lately, but I feel like it would kind of encapsulate that era really well. You know, and maybe you could get The Rock to come and, you know, reprise his role from real life when he opened the XFL season. So yeah, that's my pick.
I reckon The Rock would be open to doing that.
The Rock's open to do anything, I think, as long as the money's right.
Yeah. Well, my idea, I mean, we've been talking about like a team that sort of like lost everything. And so like, and, you know, haven't been too great. And so like, it got me thinking about whether a team had gone like a full season without any wins and sort of like how often it happens or how often it doesn't really happen. You know, I don't think. Does it, Dan? I know you're laughing.
The Browns went 0-16 5 or 6 years ago.
Okay.
And the Lions went 0-16 in 2008. But I don't know about before that. It's not something that happens regularly by any stretch. Like, you have to be pretty terrible to not even like stumble into a win at some point.
All right. Well, I think this team was pretty terrible. And so I looked up what the longest losing streak in the history of American football, or at least like top flight American football, was. And it's the Chicago Cardinals, who lost, lost 29 games in a stretch that spanned four seasons from 1942 to 1945. They posted records of 3-8, 0-10, 0-10, and 1-9 throughout those four seasons. And it started with a 7-3 loss to the Cleveland Rams, and it ended in a 16-7 win against the Chicago Bears, that 29-game losing streak. And so pretty bad. But yeah, I think just like looking at a team that sort of like, I guess, went back-to-back zero-win seasons and just like the streak overall.
I feel like we got to cut teams during the Second World War a little bit of slack. Like, come on. It would make an interesting movie because you'd have guys going off to war, you know, and that whole subplot as part of it. But let's not like jump on the, you know, like they were that bad. It was a bad time to be a footballer.
Chicago sports added to my idea, Dan, so that's good.
Chicago sports teams paid a hell of a toll in the build up to the Michael Jordan era, didn't they? Like, they didn't win a lot, and then they had Michael
and
Jordan.
And since.
Yeah, exactly.
It's almost like, you know, that one man is the only reason to be a sports fan in that city for the last 100 years or so.
Absolutely. You'd pay that price, though, if he was playing for your team. You know, that kind of skill set transferable to whatever sport. Man, I would 100%.
Why those Boston kids are so lucky. They've had Celtics and Patriots and the Red Sox all in one era.
Yeah.
A bit of Jack Lengel, you know, poaching or recruiting there, just like getting cross-sport players.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that does now bring us to the end of the episode. So, Dan, Stu, would you like to share your social media handles and anywhere else where our listeners can find you?
You can find me at dcoppel. Wherever you get your social media fix. And when they are back from break, you can hear me on Ascending Olympus and Over a Third, which are both podcasts on the Edge of the Crowd Network.
You can catch me on After Extra Time as usual. And, you know, just supporting the main cast here on Goals on Film. Jason, you're the man. I'm rarely prepared, so and also at Stewie Sick of It on Twitter and at Stewie the Sports Guy on Instagram and TikTok. Where can we find you, Jason?
Yeah, you can find me on both Twitter and Instagram at Jace Irves. That's the handle for both of them. You have been listening to Goals on Film. You can find Goals on Film on Twitter and Instagram at Goals on Film Pod. Goals on Film is part of the Edge of the Crowd Network. You can find Edge of the Crowd on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, YouTube, and TikTok at Edge of the Crowd. You can also view any of our stories, be it sport, culture, or politics, on our website, www.edgeofthecrowd.com. Until next week, thanks for listening.